An increase in scholarly attention devoted to Jewish Orthodox historiography. To the best of my knowledge, the first to characterize this genre and analyze a number of case studies, primarily the posthumously published memoirs of Rabbi Yaakov Alevi Lifshitz, is Israel Bartal. He overall points to issues of counter-history, polemics, selectivity in sources, the educational values of studying history for the present rather than for the sake of knowing the past, etc. Others, such as David Asaf, Rachel Elior, Emmanuel Etkes, Chaim Gertner, and other Rappaport and Albert, have devoted studies or parts of them to other cases of Orthodox historiography and historiographers. The majority of these works focus on 19th and early 20th century East European case studies and subgenres of this literature, or contemporary Orthodox or Haredi representations of modern European Orthodox and Haredi personalities or events. In contrast to this body of knowledge, 20th century American Orthodox historiography, the early roots of which can be found in the late 19th century, have been generally overlooked from an academic scholarly point of view. The fact that this genre, in and of itself, has not been uncovered will undoubtedly not surprise the host of the most distinguished scholars of modern Jewish history in general, and American Jewish history in particular sitting in this room, since it can be added to a long list of other sources of American Jewish history that remain untouched. However, upon discovering the problematic nature of Orthodox historiography as a historical source, it is by far more interesting to note how many scholars have and continue to perceive this problematic source as reliable in their efforts to reconstruct the past. Although backing up this statement with a few examples would be quite entertaining, I would prefer to use this wonderful opportunity provided by the initiative of Alan Brill and Mark Shapiro in order to contextualize, raise some basic questions, and offer preliminary observations regarding Orthodox historiography in America in the 1920s, and conclude with a few remarks with regard to its relevance vis-a-vis modern Orthodoxy. In an effort to achieve this modest aim, I will relate to Rabbi Dr. Auerbach's A Survey of Jewish History, the eighth booklet of the first series of the Jewish Library edited by Rabbi Dr. Liu Young. Prior to examining this book, allow me to relate to the term modern Orthodoxy. I'll do it briefly. To the best of my knowledge, there is no agreeable scholarly working definition for modern Orthodoxy, and this lacune manifests itself in several ways. Certain authors, such as David Zinger, in his most recent analysis of the 1966 Greenberg-Lichtenstein debate, do not offer any definitions to begin with, and assume that their readers know it when they see it. As a result, they avoid the challenge of suggesting if and under which conditions would a person possibly be considered as one who left the modern Orthodox fold. In that case, maybe it's Greenberg. Several definitions and characteristics suggested or implied by certain scholars have been seriously questioned, if not rejected by their colleagues, whether they're sociologists, historians, or scholars of Jewish thought. Without going into a detailed account, one example is Lawrence Kaplan's critical review of Samuel Heilman's book, Synagogue Life, in which Kaplan argues that Heilman both avoided defining modern Orthodoxy and the nature of the modern Orthodox Jew, and that some of his implied definitions and characterizations are inaccurate if not incorrect. Finally, certain scholars, consciously or otherwise, redefine modern Orthodoxy in their later works, if not possibly rejected their earlier definitions. For example, in the mid-1960s, Charles Liebman defined modern Orthodoxy as, quote, those individuals and institutions among the committed Orthodox who tend toward the church end of the church-sect continuum. On the one hand, they seek to demonstrate the viability of halakha for contemporary life. On the other, they emphasize what they have in common with all other Jews rather than what separates them. He continues to identify modern Orthodox rank and file as composing, quote, almost the entire upper-income, well-educated strata of the committed Orthodox. Liebman emphasizes that this group has, quote again, not produced any systematic statement of their ideology, but, now, end quote, but raises two ideological characteristics based upon Immanuel Ratman's writings, a radical interpretation of halakha, and the need to cooperate with non-Orthodox groups and associate organizationally with Reform and conservative rabbis. 33 years later, Liebman defined modern Orthodoxy, quote, as the effort to adapt Orthodox Judaism to modernity and to avoid the social and or cultural isolation which living in strict accordance with halakha would seem to impose. These crystal clear definitions clearly differ and partially contradict each other. But unfortunately, Liebman is not here with us to explain what led him to reformulate his initial definition. In addition to our debate in this conference with regard to the possible definitions of modern Orthodoxy, I would like to emphasize that relating to Auerbach's book as modern Orthodox historiography is anachronistic. First and foremost, Auerbach did not define or consider himself modern Orthodox, nor did his contemporaries define him as such. They could not have defined him modern Orthodox since this term did not exist at the time as a specific socio-religious category, certainly not in America. For example, in Leo Young's essay, What is Orthodox Judaism, that appeared in 1927, the term modern Orthodoxy does not appear, whereas the terms Torah true Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, and modernity appear commonly in it. Furthermore, the internal pamphlet of the Conservative Association, the United Synagogue of America, includes a self-definitive use of the term modern Orthodoxy in the 1920s, most probably in order to distinguish itself from all that was to the left religiously. And I presume Jonathan will relate to that, so I won't continue. In other words, the term modern Orthodoxy can be meaningful only from the moment we detect a significant other form of Orthodoxy. But this did not exist in the early or mid-1920s. The relocation and establishment of Orthodox yeshivas in America in the late 1920s and 1930s did indeed set the grounds for a relatively conservative Orthodox-identified enclave within American Orthodoxy, but it nevertheless was not recognized as an inherently different group, but rather another stream within the broader Orthodox camp that only changes in the 40s, as far as I know. After risking the basic legitimacy of my taking part in this conference, there are two possible justifications to include Auerbach in his book within the confines of a discussion relating to modern Orthodoxy. One, Auerbach was associated with the moderate Haredi camp in both Germany and later in Palestine. At the same time, as Young was a central figure among the American Orthodox rabbis who, following the mass migration, detached themselves from the relatively staunch and culturally uncompromising immigrant Orthodox rabbis and their Agudat HaRabbanim. In 1926, Young, as well as other Orthodox rabbis, were instrumental in uniting the English-speaking Orthodox rabbis and forming the Alternative Rabbinical Council of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, known later as the RCA. In other words, these moderate Orthodox rabbis can be considered, even if partially, as forerunners of the modern Orthodox movement that will emerge some two decades later. Two, although some years later, a considerable portion of the audience and purchases of the Jewish Library book series was indeed modern Orthodox. Rabbi Dr. Moshe Auerbach was born in Halberstadt, Germany, to a locally central rabbinic dynasty. Both his grandfather and father served as rabbis of this town. After learning with his father and others, Auerbach relocated in 1900 to the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. While studying at the seminary, Auerbach began his studies at the University of Strasbourg, receiving his PhD in 1905. After teaching at Berlin's Haredi Adat Yisrael School for approximately 2 years, Auerbach accepted an invitation to teach at the Teachers Seminary in Köln, and in the summer of 1909 he immigrated to Palestine. According to Auerbach himself, under the influence of Jacob Rosenheim, who 3 years earlier founded an organization with a view to promote religious education in Palestine, he relocated, Auerbach, to serve as a teacher and headmaster of Netzach Yisrael School in Petah Tikva. Over the next 8 years, Auerbach was instrumental in expanding the school and its branches, promoting Haredi education in Palestine, or moderate Haredi education. In 1917, Auerbach left Palestine, most probably due to the policies of the Turkish authorities, like several other educational figures, such as David Yelling, head of the Hebrew Teachers Seminary in Jerusalem, and Eliezer Meir Lifshitz, who taught at the time at Yelling Seminary and subsequently founded the Mizrahi Teachers Seminary in Jerusalem. After spending a short time in Germany, Auerbach continued to Warsaw to head the local school for Haredi girls, Chabatzilit. Soon after the First World War ended, he returned to Köln to teach at the Teachers Seminary that he studied at some years earlier, and in 1922 he accepted an offer from the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin to serve as a lecturer, docent, of Talmud and Jewish history. In 1934, Auerbach returned to Petah Tikva, and in addition to directing Netzach Yisrael, he also had an official municipal job. In 1947, he left Netzach Yisrael and continued for years to be active in Haredi education in Petah Tikva and Tel Aviv as well. It seems reasonable to assume that Young approached Auerbach regarding the possibility of writing a popular overview of Jewish history in the early 1920s while Auerbach taught at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. This is not surprising considering the fact that in 1920, Young himself graduated from this seminary and most probably knew Auerbach. Furthermore, by that time, Auerbach gained a reputation as an author of several historical publications. Finally, and probably most significantly, it appears that Auerbach represented the combination that Jan was looking for. Jews who were committed to Orthodox values, beliefs, and practices, and who were trained in East European yeshivas or Orthodox/Orthodox-oriented seminaries, as well as graduates of universities who earned advanced degrees. In other words, a combination of a historical critical approach together with Orthodox values, whereby the latter clearly overruled the former. These are the common intellectual spiritual characteristics of most authors of the first and second series of the Jewish Library Project. Examples include Joseph Carlebach, Isidore Epstein, Moses Gaster, Jacob Hofschander, David de Solapool, Oscar Wolfsberg, Ken Shayahu Aviad, as he was known later, and a few others. Interestingly, while almost all these personalities were born in the 1880s and shared the aforementioned combination of Orthodox and academic qualifications together with a clear obligation to Orthodoxy, their Jewish political affiliations were dissimilar. Some, like Auerbach, were associated with Agudat Yisrael or Poalei Agudat Yisrael, whereas others, such as Wolfsberg, were identified with Mizrahi. Most of them were affiliated at the time with academic universities or with the Jewish Theological Seminary, and not with staunch Orthodox or Haredi yeshivas or rabbinical seminaries. A careful reading of Auerbach's book uncovers several basic themes and characteristics, some of which are clear from the text itself, whereas the full meaning of others arises after placing them within certain relevant historical and comparative contexts. In the remaining time I have, I would like to focus on a few of them. The overruling theme in this book is undoubtedly the uniqueness of the Jewish people's survival throughout history, and the fact that this phenomenon can be explained only by divine providence. Consequently, the basic explanation for events and processes is given. Furthermore, this leads to emphasizing the religious educational role of history in present times. In other words, studying the past is a well-worthy cause as in so far as it has a moral religious educational message for the present. This overruling theme, which is common in religious historiography in general, has numerous implications on the way in which the past is constructed, explained, and presented to the reader. For example, the fact that God is responsible for everything that happens to the Jewish people naturally leads to providing theological explanations for historical events and developments. Thus, in line with the sages, Auerbach explains the destruction of the first temple as a result of Israel's, quote, fall from the heights assigned to it, and the fall of Judea to Israel, quote, falling away to idolatry. In addition, the very basic construction of Jewish history along the lines of, quote, the rise and fall of, and, quote, from independence to exile, and vice versa, is simultaneously based upon and denotes the essential role of God in Jewish history. Auerbach opens his book by stating that, quote, the history of the Jewish people may be divided into two main periods, Israel in its homeland and Israel in exile. In addition to setting forth the historical stage with God at its center, Auerbach is clearly influenced by and responding to modern Jewish national and Zionist historiography that reconstructed Jewish history along this dichotomy, although not necessarily from a religious point of view. This approach is strikingly similar to that presented 15 years later, in 1942, by the Commission on Education of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, chaired by Leo Young. This commission, including Yekutiel Ginsburg, Leo Hurwitz, Samuel Mirsky, Jacob Hartstein, and Joseph Kamenetsky, proposed a curriculum, quote, for the first 6 years of the elementary department of the Talmud Torah. Upon stating that, quote, many of the teachers of Hebrew schools are the products of a well-timed shama, in which godless Jewish nationalism forms the basis of instruction, and rejecting, quote, such teachers as not only unfit, but a pernicious influence, Young, who designed this curriculum, writes that, quote, to us, exile and Eretz Israel are complementary forms of divinely designed Jewish tasks. Reminds somewhat the Reform ideology, although in reverse, of course. Another related point is the continuous focus on religious history. Aside from a few social, economic, or demographic brief notes, Auerbach highlights religious history, specifically religious leaders, personalities, movements, and institutions. For example, he notes the contributions of Surah and Pumbedita, Sadiago, and Yuda Levi, Maimonides, Rashi, Rashba, the Zohar, Baal Shem Tov, I was skipping, Agoni Vilna, Moses Mendelssohn, he moves on to the Reform Movement, the Enlightenment, Ken Haskalah, Samson, Raphael Hirsch, and Israel Hildesheimer, quite obviously. Finally, in his representation of Herzl and the Zionist movement, Auerbach strongly emphasizes aspects of religion and Jewish identity as well. Thus far, aside from a few nuances, this thick description corresponds to the scholarly documented characteristics of Orthodox historiography. However, a comparative and developmental approach to publications of Orthodox historiographers geared for different audiences enables us to move this field of interest one step further. Auerbach devotes the first few pages of his book to the biblical period, starting with Abraham, although this is not surprising considering the aforementioned centrality of religious history and God's role in Jewish history. It contradicts the tendency of Orthodox historiography not to refer to this period due to various reasons, such as the wish to avoid any discussion regarding the historical reliability of the Bible and prophets. In light of the situation, Orthodox historiography typically begins after the destruction of the Second Temple. Moreover, 17 years after Auerbach's book appeared, he published the first volume of his history book in Hebrew for high school age girls studying in Haredi schools in Palestine. The second and third volumes of this book appeared within the next 3 years, thus offering an overview of Jewish history from the destruction of the Second Temple period until the development of Hasidism. This textbook avoids any discussion of earlier developments, events, and personalities in Jewish histories. In other words, what had been accepted chronologically as being within the limits of American Orthodox historiography in the 1920s, at least in the eyes of Leo Young, was unacceptable in Palestine less than 20 years later. Furthermore, it is interesting to note that one of the internal Haredi criticisms of Auerbach's textbook was that it does not sufficiently emphasize the role of divine, miraculous providence in Jewish history, notwithstanding the fact that Auerbach emphasizes this theme in his introduction to the second volume. In other words, not all books written by Orthodox historiographers are accepted equally and awarded the same degree of legitimacy in various Orthodox circles. This observation leads me to pose several questions with regard to Young, specifically in American Orthodox historiography in general. Why did Leo Young turn to Auerbach, a European Orthodox scholar who never lived in America, in order to write a book in English for an American Jewish audience? Could he not find one possible worthy local candidate, such as Bernard Revel or Chaim Hirschenzon, who could take this task upon himself and relate to Jewish history in light of the challenges that American Jewish Orthodoxy faced during this period, and do so within an Orthodox framework? What is the possible relevance of a religious educational Eurocentric history book that includes only one sentence relating to America, in which the author barely mentions the mass immigration of Jews from the Russian Empire to Western Europe and America in the late 19th century? Although much additional research is needed to answer these and other questions, it seems as though Young's Jewish Library Project is an early step in the gradual process of forming an independent genre of Orthodox historiography in America, similar to the gradual process of independence that immigrant Orthodox rabbis underwent with regard to European halachic authorities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Menachem Blondheim has documented how, at the turn of the centuries, American Orthodox decisors sort of detach themselves and create a situation where they say there's no point sending Shilas and Chuvas to Eastern Europe. They don't know the situation here. They don't know the reality of life. So long. And some East European rabbis also supported this notion, like Yitzhak Elchanan's faith, for example. It seems as though understanding this process and its possible implications might provide some answers as well as an insight to Young himself. For example, the question of the potential audience of Auerbach's book. Less than two decades after it appeared, we recognize the initial formative steps of modern Orthodoxy in America as distinguished from earlier versions of moderate Orthodoxy. Soon thereafter, a rising number of modern Orthodox Jews possessed certain volumes or full sets of Leo Young's Jewish Library series. But who was the audience of these books in the second half of the 1920s and during the 1930s? It seems unlikely to assume that this literature could be of potential interest to the scores of non-observant Orthodox Jews, as characterized by Charles Liebman and Jeffrey Burrow, or to the cultural milieu of New York's Jewish Jews, as vividly described by Jenna Weissman Joselyn, some of whom were members in Young's congregation. If this is correct, we interestingly may be facing a similar situation to that we know with regard to Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Kaplan. As many scholars have pointed out, a most central criticism that Kaplan leveled against Reform, Orthodox, and Conservative Judaism in the first part of his Judaism as a civilization was that they were incomplete, outdated, inconsistent, and consequently irrelevant on both intellectual and religious levels to the average young American Jew. Yet at the same time, Kaplan's perceptions of the intellectual nature and characteristics, as well as beliefs of the typical young Jewish male or female in America in the first decades of the 20th century, fit only a small portion of this population, which explains, at least in part, why the alternative he suggested did not appeal to wide audiences. In our case, is it possible that Leo Young created a certain image of the ideal type young American Orthodox Jew, who in reality may have existed but did not represent the rank and file of young Orthodox Jews at the time? If so, one could possibly attribute this similarity between Kaplan and Young to some mystical influence of the position in the Jewish center that both of them held. Since otherwise, interestingly enough, it is fascinating how these two figures, who shared such strong ties with the rank and file Jew, who saw such great importance in serving as communal rabbis, and who were revered by their congregants as being connected to contemporary Jewish life and concerns in America as any rabbi can be, could offer such a detached from reality portrait of the average young American Jew. Exploring American Orthodox historiography seems to open several thus far untouched aspects pertaining to the nature and development of Orthodox historiography, as well as wider basic social historical questions with regard to American Orthodoxy, as well as the origins and nature of American Jewish modern Orthodoxy. Thank you.
Thank you for a very, very interesting, very provocative presentation. Now, Dr. Stephen Fine of Chu University, and then we'll do questions and discussion after.
First, I'd like to thank Alan and Mark for putting together this really wonderful day, a few days. Everybody hear me?